Hello and welcome to I Am The Egg Pod with me, Chris Shaw. The Egg Pods take a jaunty stroll through Pepperland, discussing the Beatles and solo Beatle albums with a potpourri of delicious guests. In this episode, I can't believe it, it's Youth. Hello.
Hi, Chris.
How are you?
I'm good, thank you. How's it all going?
Oh, wonderful, wonderful. It's 2021, or is it 2020? I've forgotten.
It's 21.
It is. We were just talking before we started this. We've had John Higgs on before, and he's like one of the most popular guests ever, really, and he did Rush's, which is a lot of Beatles or solo Beatle fans may not have heard, but it's had such a huge, huge impact. And I think it's opened a whole new world of Paul McCartney solo albums or duets or whatever you want to call it. How did your involvement with Paul, I mean, I guess it was on Off the Ground where you first sort of met up?
Well, Strawberry Ships came out of Paul asking me to remix something from that, but I suggested we just take sounds from it and create something else, and that turned into that album. And then we enjoyed that a lot, and he suggested we do another one, which was Rush's, and we seem to do them every 10 years around.
Yeah,
there's a 10-year gap, and I think they fall for a lot of McCartney aficionados. They kind of fall into his experimental bracket of music that he does outside of his solo work or Wings or Beatles. Then he has the experimental stuff like Thrillington and other weird things he's done.
I don't think they're weird.
No, but I mean, initially we did them. We did it anonymously, and he didn't. You know, he didn't have his name on it, and that was a bit weird and different. And then whenever we've done it, it seemed to be very liberating from him, from having had to spend a lot of focused time on a solo album or band album or a symphony or whatever else he's doing, a film, you know. So they were experiments that allowed him just to cut loose and be an artist again and experiment, really. And that was quite a release for him. After all the consideration of being Paul McCartney, he could just be a kid in a toy shop having fun, you know, again.
Yeah.
So when I listened back to like Electric Arguments yesterday in preparation for this, you can hear that. And even though that's actually the most developed one of the three we did, because we've got songs on them, on Electric Arguments, those songs came together so fast. I mean, we would do, I don't know, sometimes two or three a day for nothing.
Wow.
At least one, sometimes, often two, and occasionally three. And he really enjoyed that. And that would be an 8-hour day. It wasn't a 14-hour day. You know, it might have been a 14-hour day for me, but the thing with Paul, when working with Paul, I tend to get up early and go down to the studio early and prepare some ideas and vibes. And I think that worked really well. Actually, I was listening to an interview recently. Well, it was with The Edge, and he was talking about working with Eno on Not Forgettable Fire, but With or Without You album.
Joshua Tree?
And Joshua Tree, yeah. And he said that what he quite liked about Eno as a producer was that, again, he'd get to the studio about 11, 12, and Eno had already been in there for 3 or 4 hours, and he'd have 3 or 4, like, backing tracks.
Right.
That he was playing around with. And he'd go, what do you think of that? Or what do you think of that? And I think With or Without You was one of those.
Mm.
And with Paul, I'd prepare 3 or 4 ideas, not arranged, but just vibes. But they'd all have specific source directions. So one might be like specifically for Electric Arguments, one might be like a Nick Drake English acoustic arpeggio. Another might be a blues beat or rhythm or riff or something. They were all, you know, other ones might be more ambient. And then he'd come in and I'd go, okay, I've got these 3-4 little ideas going, loops going, no chord changes. And he'd go, okay, let's hear them. And I'd play them to him. And then he got quite like the third one. Okay, well, I said, okay, great, let's start that. Yeah. So, and then we'd start, you know, tracking them up, and then I'd get him to play the part. My philosophy was basically try and get Paul to do as much of the recording as possible. So, but occasionally he'd ask me to play something. Occasionally it'd be a bass. Foolishly, I agreed once.
That's some rushes, isn't it?
Yeah, but even on Electric Arguments, I think when he was doing drum tracks, I might have done a guide bass just to be there in the room with him, you know?
Yeah, must be hard to resist.
So, I'm a sort of I'm a big enough dreamer and fool to be able to just walk into those shoes without even thinking about it too much, which is probably the best way of dealing with it. Yeah. But even before we started, my intention was always to make it as much about Paul as possible, and to facilitate him and to get him to play as much as possible on it. So that was fine. And I think he really enjoyed the direction of being, I'd go, okay, let's do the arpeggio acoustic and do some strums, and let's try one with the capo and do another one with a different guitar, and then let's put a harpsichord. He'd just go with it. And then, of course, he'd get engaged. And then we get a vibe and arrangement. Well, actually, I'd start, we do that for a couple of hours. Then I'd say, okay, you start writing some lyrics. Here are the poetry books. I brought down a huge, not huge, but about 12 or 15 different poetry books of different beat poets generally. And I'd say, you know, okay, let's start off with this one. We'll pick a couple of random pages. If there's any words that jump out, take that word, write it down, or if it's a phrase, take the phrase, whatever, just write it all down, just skim through, and then I'll cut them all up and we'll throw them up and then see if you can find sentences out of it, and out of that, see if there's a story. So he absolutely leapt at that, because, again, it was a fun thing. It wasn't like, oh, write me a song, please, right now. It was like, let's play a game and have some fun. And it's a surefire technique to get around any kind of writer's block as well, because you're actually getting the source information right there, and then you're just rearranging it, throwing it. And then by the 90s, ideas of originality were kind of defunct, and it became more about being authentic to the source. I've been kind of playing with those ideas for a while, because in the 80s we were doing the Orb and KLF hip hop, all of that was going on, and it was all about basically sampling music, making new music out of that. And I read an interview where I'd heard that one of the techniques the Bee Gees did to write was they put a 4-bar or an 8-bar loop up of a Beatles track, maybe just 4 bars from a middle 8 or something, and they loop it, and then they just jam along to it until something came up.
Really? Wow.
But I think that was one of, they used that in getting like Staying Alive, or one of those like really good ones. Yeah. And if you listen to Staying Alive and stuff, there is like a drum loop going on in there, you know?
Yeah.
And I thought, wow, that's such a great fearless way of writing. And also goes way beyond the idea of originality. It's like going to the source of what you love. But nevertheless, with Paul, I thought, Paul has inspired so much music, so many musicians to be musicians. If anyone's allowed to do a loop and jam along to it to make a song, it's him.
It is indeed.
And, of course, if you unpack those Beatles records, they always wear their heart on their sleeve. They're totally open about the sources and where they're coming from, whether it's the Everly Brother harmonies or the Beach Boys harmonies or the Little Richard move, or, you know, they're all about being authentic to their sources, you know. And in doing so, paradoxically, they created some of the most original music ever made. So, you know, this is what I try and tell young artists I work with a lot, you know, that cling to these ideas of originality. I don't listen to other people's music because I want to be original. And I'm like, you won't be original, you'll be boring. And not only boring, you'll sound like a cliche, because that's what happens when you do that. And most artists and writers have tried to do that, and we've all done it. And you end up in this sort of like cul-de-sac of nowhere. And it's actually the really great artists, they just go straight to the source and go, yeah. And then they just have it.
Yeah.
You know, and then they turn it into an original piece of music through their story. So that, using those kind of techniques with a writer like Paul was a very risky experiment, because on Rushes, I'd actually tried to get a vocal with him, which partly ended up on the record with Let Me Love You, which was a refrain, but we never really got a verse. And I remember we were doing a session, I said, come on, let's have a go at doing a verse on Let Me Love You. And he got up and he just started looking out the window and goes, yeah, the rabbit's on the grass, how's that? I said, look, maybe just go and work on the lyric and see. He goes, oh, you don't like it? I was like, well, you know, just maybe think about it, you know, see what comes up. And he goes, it's out of time. And he literally walked out. Next day he goes, I don't want to do that again. And I could see, you know, an artist of that stature, you know, they're looking down at a great height on incredible work that they don't even know how they make. And they're thinking, well, I've got to make a record that stands next to that. How am I ever going to do that? It's intense, you know. And you got some kid producer going, oh, I don't like the lyric. Or, I know with Chaos and Creation producer, a Radiohead's producer.
Oh, Godric.
Nigel, yeah, lovely guy. And, you know, I know he had a lot of problems on that album on how tough he could go and how far he could, you know. I think there were a couple of occasions where the sessions did grind to a halt. But I actually had a cosmic meeting with Nigel at a mutual friend's wedding on the island of Hearn around that time. This must have been 20 years ago or so now. And we were chatting away. I'd met him a few times. He's a lovely guy. And he was about to go in to work with Paul. And then he started talking about his anxieties on the upcoming McCartney album. That's great. But because I'd already worked with Paul a fair bit by then, my advice really was like, I mean, I didn't have to tell Nigel any advice anyway, but I was like, the hardest part is how you're going to manage with hopefully the tact and diplomacy you need, telling an artist of the stature of Bob Dylan or Paul McCartney or Elvis Presley, you don't think that song's good enough for the cut, you know. Which is one of the primary roles of a producer, actually, is choosing the songs and making sure the songs are all good, even if the producer's not writing them.
George Martin did that, didn't he? George Martin, before Tug of War, he called Paul in and said, right, if I'm going to produce this, I'm producing it.
Oh, did he? I didn't know that.
Yeah,
was that
yeah.
the Monster album?
Yes. And he said, you know, we're going to lay down the ground rules. And Paul seemed to love it. I mean, what an Tug of War. You know, that's a phenomenal album. And George really
well,
got...
That's I mean, if I was, you know, in a position of Paul and George Martin was saying that, I'd probably take it, you know. But if it was something like 28-year-old up and coming, you know, kid, he's had a couple of hit albums, I'd be like, what do you know?
But
whoever it is, with an artist of that stature, is absolutely a very, very difficult challenge. I mean, because I remember with Wings, you know, at the time, Wings weren't cool. You know, it's like the Alan Partridge joke of the Beatles could have been Wings, you know. but if you listen to Wings now, and even from the last 15 years or so, I mean, it's almost as good as the Beatles. It really is.
Yeah.
Sometimes when you see them do a show, you can't. Because maybe I'm amazed. You go, maybe I'm amazed. What was that Beatles album that was on? You know, of course, it's a solo record, but you know, when you put them.
Yeah.
Bookend them with all the other ones. They just sound like one thing, you know.
Yeah.
And formidable. But a lot of those Beatles records, I mean, Wings records were really great. And actually, I felt with Paul, I didn't want to reference the Beatles too much at all, if at all, really, because he'd already done that so many times on his other solo records. And this was supposed to be experimental and, you know, groundbreaking. So, but what I did do was, which I thought was fair, was to reference some of the Beatle influences, like Buddy Holly or Everly Brothers, and even Phil Spector. At first, he wasn't happy about me referencing Phil Spector. But by the end, by Electric Arguments, he was totally cool about it. He'd softened about it. I think because he got his naked version of Let It Be out and put it out of the system a bit, you know. Yeah. And so he could then be just in love with Spectre as he was when he was 20 or something. But that was good because it was nice, you know, getting that influence in there. And but then I was also on Electric Arguments. There's a couple of two or three tracks where I'm actually referencing tracks from Band on the Run and Venus and Mars and stuff, and some of the arrangements as well, and the acoustic work, because those albums are incredible, aren't they? The production and the songs and the segueing, and then all the things people criticize them for, like Linda's backing vocals, amazing, you know, all the keyboard work.
I was going to say, before we sort of go through the songs on Electric Arguments, tell me about the Rushes album. That must have been a real challenge. I think it's been described as a requiem for Linda.
That's what it became. Because we weren't, or I wasn't aware of how ill she was at first. But then it became apparent. But having her contributions in that was great. And even me just recording her and Paul riding their horses over the misty hills where the studio was a great experience and full of joy and laughter, and, you know, it's beautiful.
Yeah. Palo Verde's become a real loved song since that John Higgs episode we did, and it's just opened up. You know, a lot of people may have just listened to it, and it's just, they may not have read into what it actually meant to Paul, I think.
Yeah. It's a powerful poem, and I just think, I was so lucky to have got to know Linda before she died and work with her. And I realise now just how powerful an influence she was with Paul in getting him over the Beatles, getting him back on his feet, always there, always got his back, always giving him the encouragement to do what he wanted to do. She had an amazing way around him. I think she picked that up from herself being a photojournalist and working with a lot of bands before Paul, but also her father, Lee, had dealings with a lot of the big New York artists like the Kooning, and she was hanging out with them, and they were hanging out with them and hanging out in their studios, and she had an easy rapport around genius, you know. So. Yeah. But she wasn't easy. She was tough. First day I worked with Paul, we did a bit of recording, then he went away, and then he said, I'll be back in a couple of hours. And he came back in, like, listened to what I'd done. He said, oh, I love it. I think it's great. He said, but I'm going to have to run it past Linda, because if Linda doesn't like it, it's not going to happen, you know.
Wow.
And he kind of made her out to be this fierce, you know, Sergeant Major type figure. And then, of course, she came in and just immediately started dancing and was so cool and not like that. Yeah. It's just winding me up.
Lie down beside me.
So Electric Arguments, the album. I've got to start, because on track one, Nothing Too Much, Just Out of Sight. I remember the first time I heard this, and it was on, I think it was Simon Mayo's show, and they were doing a preview, and it just blew my socks off. It was like hearing Helter Skelter for the first time. Tell me about this. So was this from scratch? Was this literally nothing when you came into the studio?
That's right. There were a couple of tracks up. Paul actually had some riffs he had been kicking around with, like Two Magpies and things. But pretty much everything else came from me, as I was saying earlier, you know, creating these little sort of sound template vibe ideas early in the morning before he came in as a possible direction, you know, or as a starting point for something, you know. And so, you know, Nothing Too Much. Actually, the inspiration for me with that was I discovered if you wanted to do a really cool blues riff but make it not sound like a cliche, you do it in 5/4 instead of 4/4. You add an extra beat.
Right.
And it turns it into something completely different. So the actual riff, I think I was referencing some folk record. It could have been Fairport. That would have been funny, because actually I was listening to a Richard Thompson interview last night, and Richard Thompson was, you know, he was the founder of Fairport Convention and became this legendary session guitarist. And he said that him and Sandy Denny had been invited to a Paul McCartney garden party in the 70s, and he didn't go.
All right.
because in his own words, he said he was too much of a snob musically. He said if Dylan had invited him, he would have gone. But with Mackay, he was like, well, our Beatles are a bit pop, you know. I couldn't believe it. But I thought it was great testament to his authenticity that he could say that now and not feel like the Decca guy who turned down the Beatles. Anyway, to his lovely credit, I think that's a great endearment of Richard that he didn't go to a comedy garden.
So that 5/4, I never would have picked up on this song a Fairport Convention influence.
Well, I don't know if it's Fairport. It could have been a Sandy Denny. It could have been the Trees, actually. It could have been a lot of one of those sort of early 70s folk rock things. But it was an acoustic riff. But I thought, actually, if you put that through a fuzz box, add another beat, you've got a really killer kind of blues riff. And I thought, what would be great with that? What I wanted to do with that track was referencing the Beatles. I wanted to do a track that was some way occupying the same space, you know, cosmically, as Helter Skelter. Because one of the things people, I mean, out of many things people misguidedly think about Paul is that, you know, he was the nice one in the Beatles, you know.
We'll leave that there.
And it was John who was the tough, edgy, you know, one, you know.
Yeah.
But Paul's as tough as they come. And Paul was actually the working class one, and John was the middle class one. And Paul could rock as hard as Lennon or anyone else, you know, and Helter Skelter's testament to that. He told me that they'd gone. When they'd done Helter Skelter, he'd read that morning that the Who had made the loudest rock record ever, and he thought, fuck that, I'll show them. And then they went in and did Helter Skelter, which is wonderful. I think that's a positive side of competition, isn't it? Sometimes when you kind of like trying up the ante of somebody else. So for me, I was trying to set a little bit the bar of Helter Skelter. I mean, obviously I'm never going to get Helter Skelter, and not necessarily wanted to get Helter Skelter considering all the legacy of that, well, you know. Yeah. But I wanted to illustrate Paul's rock blues sensibility. Yeah, Dig a Pony and things like that. I mean, there's a lot of blues in the Beatles, even though people think of the Stones as being the blues-based band of the 60s, but there was a lot of blues in the Beatles as well. And and Paul's got a fierce rock growl.
Yeah.
That was the idea with that, and Paul kind of just leapt at it.
There's footage, isn't there, because you're in Hog Hill recording all these, aren't you?
Yeah.
And there's some footage of him there with a slide, and he's just kind of doing it. He's making it up as he's going along, and it's amazing.
You can imagine, for me, it's like having Paul McCartney as your human jukebox, you know, musical jukebox. He's so talented, and he can play everything. I mean, he's a phenomenal drummer, one of the best bass players, but he's ridiculously good guitarist, keyboard player, everything. So having that as a musical palette, as a producer or collaborator, is this incredible, you know, human jukebox in a way. And just like move the chair over to the harpsichord, go, okay, let's do one of that. Let's go to Chamberlain and do one of those. I think he really enjoyed not having to think about that side of that process as he would have on a solo record, probably, you know, depending on the collaborator, producer involved. But
yeah,
I think he quite enjoyed taking direction, not having to be the one giving direction.
He doesn't seem to be too scared about getting his hands dirty on this one with all the instrumentation.
No. I mean, he really, all the Fireman albums, he's totally vulnerable and naked there. And he's fearless about that. That's one of the things that makes him, I think, personally, one of the great artists, is so fearless about it. Yeah, it's formidable watching him work. I think the other thing he quite enjoyed is I work fast. Whatever team I brought up with me, normally just be an engineer and a programmer in those days, but there were cats I'd worked with extensively, so we could record, loop, arrange, like, so fast. Yeah. Like the way people do today, in a way, but we were doing it, you know, 20, 30 years ago. But it was quite unusual to work that fast at that time for anyone, let alone an artist like him. But he really liked that. And like also on Electric Arguments, most of the sessions, he always liked us to work on an equinox or a solstice or one of the Celtic festivals.
Right. And
that was interesting. He did have, I've got a photograph of my kitchen wall, of some of the standing stones on his land in Mull. And of course his symphony was standing stone, was inspired by that. And he has this sort of deep bardic, mysterious magic about him, but it's counterpointed by a very fierce Liverpool Catholic rationale.
Right.
So,
what a combination.
On some level, it was an odd dynamic, because sometimes he would say, "Yeah, let's record on Beltane," and I was like, "Well, that's a bit pagan." And he said, "Yeah, it'd be a vibe, you know." And then other time I talk about astrology, because I don't like talking about astrology. I think it's, you know, I'm too Catholic. So he had so many different personalities in there, actually, as most of us do. But that always made the sessions quite magical and special as well. But there would be probably in batches of 3 days over those sort of festivals. So we'd do 2 or 3 days in a row. Then I have a 6-week break, and then the next festival come up, we'll do another 2 or 3 days. But like I was saying earlier, in those 2-3 days, we record at least 3 or 4, maybe 5 tracks.
Wow.
I saw 2 magpies, a girl and a boy, 1 for sorrow, 2 for joy. With no salutes, I move away. And long to face down fear.
Moving on to 2 Magpies, an astonishing song. Can I ask, was this from scratch, or did he have some ideas for this?
He came in one morning, he goes, "Oh, I put this down on my phone last night. What do you think?" And it was the acoustic riff of 2 Magpies. I was like, "Wow, that's beautiful. It's like Blackbird, you know. It's in that vein." And I said, "Oh, great. Well, I actually used some of his phone recording on it."
Yeah.
And then it goes into the full Martin J45. But that was very simple. And I think we just wanted to make it a bit different from Blackbird or anything like that. So he put a bass guitar on it. I think that might have been a double bass, actually, the Bill Black.
I was going to say, but yeah. And it's beautiful.
That came together in a couple of hours, you know.
Really?
Yeah, I mean, literally from nothing to him finishing the vocal. Yeah.
Wow. What a way to work. And then the dynamics change considerably with Sing the Changes.
Yeah, I was really blown away recently. Someone pointed out that in his own list of top 20 songs he's written, it was like number 15 or something. Or it was in the list, you know. And actually, one of the big buzzes for me with working with Paul was and has been is when I go and see him do a show after Electric Arguments, he was doing a couple of songs in the show.
Yeah,
that just segued seamlessly with amongst these massive, towering cannons of other classic songs.
Wow.
And got a great reception. I was so buzzed on that. And I think Sing the Changes with Wild and the Highway, I think he did as well. And they worked really well. And again, I think like Sing the Changes, actually, I think my sort of inspirational sort of like template of that was basically trying to go a little bit Joshua Tree, actually.
Really?
Yeah, wow. A little bit. I don't know why. Only because I quite like that expansive atmosphere of, I remember listening to that album when it came out and I was working in America and I could hear it driving down the highways there, and it came out on the radio. It sounded huge and really atmospheric. And I felt like I wanted to get something like that. And it's just two chords. It's kind of that meets Velvet Underground or something. And then he just, I think, he didn't even pre-write the lyrics on that. He said, I've got a melody idea. Let me put an idea down locally. And then out of that idea, there was Sing the Changes. And a few of the lines started coming up. And I said, yeah, you've almost got the lyric there. And he goes, put that on a cassette and I'll put it on the headphones and I'll write the lyric. And 15 minutes later, he had the lyrics.
My, oh, my. Yeah. That's astonishing.
But, you know, there's that great story of when Andrew Lou Goldham saw him getting out of a taxi and, can you come to my Stones rehearsal? Need a song. And they went in with I Want to Be Your Man, isn't it?
Yeah,
I think.
Yeah.
Well, before they played the song, they said, just give us one of your acoustics. We just need to go in this office. Just got to finish off this one bit. And the hand got a middle eight, apparently. And they went into the back office, wrote the middle eight, 5 minutes, went back in, played them the song, bang. You know?
Yeah.
And that's the kind of confidence you want to have when you're in a band writing songs at that age.
Yeah.
Because the problem with a lot of young artists today, and my kids as well, they play music, make music, they're also self-aware and considered about what they put out, you know, and they're like, oh, I've got to practice more, I've got to finish that, it's not ready, and, you know. But those artists like McCartney, those great artists, they just threw themselves off the cliff and into the jaws.
Traveling Lights. Yeah. I love this one. Mm. Tell me about this.
Mm. Well, another very atmospheric one. That one I was thinking more like I wanted some like ambience and atmosphere and just a vibe, really. But again, Paul just leapt on that really quickly and again came up with a fairly fully formed lyric on a guide vocal melody idea straight away.
Wow.
You know.
It's almost like a sea shanty.
Yeah, that's right. It's got an ancient, you're right, it's got a sea shanty thing. And I think Paul had been involved in an album of sea shanties with Johnny Depp and some people like, guy from the Foo Fighters and stuff like that had done this album of sea shanties. So he was like, I'm all into seas. And he lives near Rye, you know, it's all about pirates and, you know, anything with that sea shanty vibe is a good vibe, I think.
Yeah.
But has that ancient, ye olde time thing to it, yeah.
Oh, it's a beautiful piece. Yeah, so atmospheric as well.
Yeah,
and his voice as well.
Well, that's right. Because I think I suggested he sing it really low because of the Johnny Cash record that had happened. You know, and I said maybe go for a Johnny Cash approach on it, and we'll get this really low gravelly gravitas. And that works really well. It doesn't really sound like him, does it? It's great.
Well, he's duetting with himself, but he's actually doing two octaves apart.
That's it.
Amazing.
Because his musical, you know, knowledge is vast because his dad played, you know, and they'd sang songs around the piano, you know, and there'd be old in Liverpool, it's a sailor's town, isn't it? It's full of pirates again, you know. And so you'd have all the Irish folk influences coming up, and of course, all the American R&B and country and western. But of course, the country and western, a lot of the Irish ballads were a big deal in Liverpool. You know, a lot of the big Liverpool hits, like You'll Never Walk Alone.
Yeah.
Those are like Irish ballads, really.
And there's so many different influences in this. Because I'm guessing if you're in that studio, you've got any instrument that you just... So we get mellotrons. Haven't heard mellotrons for a while. And then at the end, where he's doing the meandering slide guitar, it's almost Sid Barrett.
Oh, yeah, that's right. I think, he was one of the people on Dark Side of the Moon where they interviewed people for the spoken word bits. He'd actually done that with Linda, but they didn't use it.
No. Apparently, because Roger Waters said he was goofing around too much, and it wasn't what he was after.
Yeah, maybe. But that's so cool that they didn't use it as well, isn't it? You know, that's a whole other evening's story. That I think we'd use that on Rushes, where we'd actually put together a load of questions for people and then pulled them in from around the studio or the farm and just gave them these questions and recorded them and used them as samples and phoned random people up. And then he put on a funny voice and pretended he was someone else. So we had referenced that a little bit, but I think he's a big Floyd fan, you know, and I think he could see Floyd as equals in a way to what they did with the Beatles and how far they pushed it, you know. And so he was open to those sort of conceptual ideas. The whole idea of the Feynman was conceptual and give him an excuse to do that, really. So, but ironically, Electric Arguments is quite a traditional album. Weirdly enough, when I listened to it yesterday, I was so happy because it sounded so good. I remember seeing a Rolling Stone review at the time saying, you know, it's his best album he'd made since Band on the Run. I couldn't believe it. And I think even though we started out trying to be really weird, avant-garde and conceptual, that album is just straight down the line, solid gold quality songs, beauty. So, you know, it came out quite traditional. It's weird. Yeah. But not really, because there's things on those songs and the ways we've done them people had never done before. That's another thing he wanted to do. He was always into doing things people had not done before, you know.
I was going to say, there's so many tracks on this that that are unique. You can't pick, you know, you might pick a song from, you know, a Wings album that sounds a bit Beatle-y, but there's a few on here that he's never done before or since, and it's all the better for it. It's amazing sounds.
Yeah, I agree.
Highway.
So that's another funny one, isn't it? Because I think the reference lyrically there is like Ticket to Ride or something. You know, it's like a streetwalker. But I'm not sure. But I remember we discussed it a little bit. Weirdly, I think, well, not weirdly, but when it came out, it was around the time of his divorce and stuff to Heather. So
yeah,
people immediately assumed that the title and arguments in the title and those songs were about her. But I couldn't actually say that. Anyway, I wouldn't say that. His lyrics. But I don't think, from what I remember, I don't think they were. I think they were about just imaginary characters, you know, and people he might have met years ago or stuff like that.
Yeah, I mean, it's quite brutal, like running through the night time and looking like a wreck, got too many highlights and a love bite on her neck. It's not complimentary.
No, but maybe, you know, I mean, don't forget, like, he'd been married for, what, 30 years or something with Linda. Then Linda died, then had another short marriage, straight back into another marriage months later or something. He'd not really spent much time being single. And when he was single, he'd get on the booze, wasn't so good when he was single, you know. So maybe songs like that are his fantasy idea of being a single guy on the road, doing things that he hadn't done for years, you know, sort of since he was in Hamburg with the Beatles or something, you know. Yeah. Maybe that's his way of, you know, not denying himself that wild, you know, experience it as a creative, you know. I'd like to think that. Why not?
Yeah.
When the sky is filled up with storms and heavy rain and troubled stars sliding across your mind, it's hard for me to see which road I've got to take. I know I need to find a way to leave it all behind. Let's shine.
So then we move on to, tell me about this. We move on to Light from Your Lighthouse. How did this happen?
This was one that was like, we'd already done a big one that day or something. And then I was like, I'll just put an idea down on this. And he'd suddenly develop it. And there it was, you know. And it came up at the end of a day. And it might have been one of the ideas I would have suggested in the morning that he'd not gone for and gone for another one. And I was, what about this one now? Just throw an idea down on it. Because once you're rolling and flowing, you've got a rapport. You know, I could ask him to do things like that. Yeah. I couldn't have done that at the beginning of the sessions, you know, or even when I first started working. The problem with Paul for producers is Paul. And actually, even if you see the clips of the Rick Rubin documentary that's come up recently, a friend of mine sort of pointed out that Rick doesn't come across very good in it. But actually, it's quite those sort of interviews, sort of doco films, they're quite revealing, aren't they? And I thought she was right. Rick didn't come across so great. Paul seemed a little bit like...
He must have told these stories. Well, he's told these stories his whole life again and again and again.
I know.
And you're not going to get anything new, really.
No, but that's the way you do it. But I haven't seen the full film, so I shouldn't criticise it. But I did see the clips, and I thought, yeah, even with Rick, you know, Paul's a tough gig for any producer or collaborator in that way. How are you ever going to, like, go further than Lennon, you know, I mean, as a collaborator? I mean, no one can ever possibly do that. It's a poison chalice in a way. Mm. And that's a very tough gig for Paul, because he's not going to get the kind of artistry development and production that he should for an artist of his stature because of that. It's like a mythical paradox, you know. But it applies to many other artists, which, again, why many of those really established legendary artists haven't made a good record for a long time, you know, because people can't go, they don't either have the tact or the diplomacy, or they can't be normal around people like that. the thing with me with Paul, as much as I enjoyed Paul rattling off the stories, which he does really great and well, and does break the ice, and it's a really great way of passing the time of the day.
Well, yeah.
I try to keep it super professional and super like, this is just another session, and maybe just employ a little bit more tact and diplomacy on how you direct the artist, but otherwise just do it as you do it. And I made a big point of just being myself and being able to relax and get into a flow of just exchange and direction and trust. And that came very quickly, really, on the first sessions we did. So by the time we're doing lecturing arguments, we've already got a comfortable rapport. Nevertheless, it's never that comfortable with Paul because he's Paul, you know? And he's not the nice one. And if it's not great, I mean, super fucking great, right? He gets pissed off, you know? He's like, why isn't it? You know, fair enough. He's absolutely right. But, you know, he's a tough cat to work with, you know, in that he puts a high bar up there. But his bar is his bar. It's not anybody else's. And that gives you like hope that what you're going to do is he's going to like, you know. But really reading between the lines of where he's at, where he was coming from, where he's going, and creating a creative space and enough challenge to unleash and unlock that imagination and creative spirit very quickly. I think where a lot of people make the mistake is they think they have to overthink it and overwork it because it is Paul, and that'll kill it often and before it's even come, you know, and then you cling to it like driftwood because that's all you've got, you know.
Yeah.
And you might be able to, you know, get away with that. So you can hear that in some of the records. I can hear that. So some of the other records, you know, of that he's made. And you can feel, I mean, all great art should be intense, but you can actually feel that there's the vibe of this isn't great, but we're going to pretend it is because it's so important, it's great. And a lot of artists can fall into that trap with a very, you know, charismatic, dynamic, persuasive producer. And at the end of it, you're like, oh, is that really? You know, but I think we had a very open and honest ground plate straight away, and I'd learned the trickiest bit was how to get him back on the vocals after the trouble I'd had on the first one, you know, and or the second one. But that just thing came together with approaching it from a beat poet perspective with the carps, and it just flowed straight away. And then he was ringing, because although once I'd clicked that one with Paul, I could then apply that same technique with other writers. But then, funnily enough, when I've tried that with other writers and artists who've got blocks, but they don't have the confidence of Paul. And so they only go so far, and it doesn't always work.
Yeah.
But with Paul, he really got it, and he really did work. Some of his best work, I think.
Every morning I get up, look out the window, I get up, see the sunshine beating down.
Sun is shining, and I think what your input into this is amazing. Something we rarely hear in Paul's songs throughout this album in particular, he's happy to stay on one chord, which really opens up the possibilities of melody and counter melody, and very much so on this song, I think.
Yeah, and I've, you know, a lot of my other productions of some of my biggest hits, Bittersweet Symphony, it's all like three chords or doesn't have any chord changes or anything. I like that. It's kind of trancey.
Yeah. And it adds to the suspense. I mean, the suspense brain, where he's changing chords on the waves are breaking in the water.
The sun is shining now. The air is buzzing. La, 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 la.
and then you're
but
just...
But on that one, we do have that melodic bass riff that breaks up and bookends the verses and choruses, and and that's very much Band on the Run or something, you know. That's one of the ones, you know, where I was like, you know, that could have been a riff off Band on the Run. It would have worked. Those might come at the end. We might have done the rest of the song and then I go, let's just do this one riff thing I'll throw in once or something, and we'll just track that up a little bit. And we'll do it at the end of the session, then I'll edit it in somewhere. And then that became the main theme and hook, you know.
Wow.
And then the next day he'll overdub over the new arrangement, and it's, you know. So,
super.
And that's a great song. It's such a joyful song. I think my brief to him on that was like, that's, you know, Sunday morning driving to the beach on a sunny day. That's the vibe. And that is the vibe. It's all right.
Well, you've got that pastoral acoustic opening and you've got birds singing. Yeah. It's such an evocative soundscape.
Yeah.
So was that how you did it for a lot of these songs? Create, would that be the description? I'm thinking of autumn in, you know, this kind of thing. Is that how vague it was? Or
yeah, we often did quite a lot of field recordings and go out and record the birds or horses galloping past or the sea or things like that, and they'd end up in the recordings that we did that day or something. And because he lives on a farm down there, or, you know, at the time he was spending a lot of time down there, it's just such a wild, fierce nature that nature can't help but inform, you know, what you're doing in the recording studio in a way. And it should inform it, I think.
Yeah.
Well, not necessarily, but it's nice if it does.
It is, believe me. So then we move on to, we mentioned him earlier, Phil Spector. We move on to Dance Till We're High.
Mm.
Tell me about this. I love this song.
Yeah, well, there you go. Yeah. So that's, again, Paul's so good with wordplay, isn't he? You know, Dance Till We're High. And, of course, you know, when we've been recording in the 90s, he'd had big parties down there. He'd have Paul Oakenfold DJing, and they were like little raves, you know.
Wow.
And the idea that you could dance yourself high without taking drugs was a long conversation we had. And of course we know now it's not just dance, but tones and music as well can totally mood change your endorphins and chemicals and inside to make you feel better without having to take a medication if as a therapy, you know. So I think that was the subject matter, was just that idea. But then there's the Spectre beat. That's kind of like a 70s song, I think. It's almost like, weirdly, when I listened to it yesterday, I thought it's a bit Traveling Wilburys in a way.
Oh, really?
Which, again, when they made that record, I thought, I was a bit disappointed when it came out. I thought it sounded too 80s and too clean or something. But when I listen to the Traveling Wilburys now, I just think it's classic, timeless, good solid gold.
Yeah.
And one of my favourite producers with Paul actually is Jeff from ELO. But the thing with Jeff is Jeff's got Jeff's sound. He's only got one sound, but it's his sound.
It is.
Even if he nicked it off the Beatles, it's his sound.
Borrowed. Homage.
Yeah. And it's the way he's got a certain drum sound that's really compressed and cranked, but it's got a sort of skiffly feel to it. I don't know. He's fucking brilliant, Jeff. And I met him a couple of times down at Hog Hill, and that was a great privilege because I'm a big fan. But the problem with sometimes when Jeff's doing it is it sounds like Jeff rather than Paul. And then it's like, what I love about that is it's kind of like a homage of a homage of a homage of a homage. It's all like six steps removed. But it ends up coming out sounding quite unique and, you know, original in a weird way. But even though it's Jeff, you know, you can't mistake that. But I think Jeff actually got some great vibes down with Paul, where they're relaxed and they're just doing their thing, you know. And the three of, I was around when they were doing the photos for Free as a Bird, and I thought they've done a great job on that. Amazing. In fact, somebody posted another song from those sessions that didn't come out because George didn't like it, apparently.
Yeah, I think that isn't, I don't think that is them. I think there's somebody at home who's got,
oh, it's somebody pretending to be them.
Yeah. They've got a John Lennon demo and overdubbed it themselves.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, there's a few out
good,
there.
Though, actually. Yeah,
it's all right, good. Actually. Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Well, you know, anything that sounds any way Lennon-y or Beatley, I'm like in generally. You know,
aren't we all?
Like, yes. So, yeah, with that one, it almost had a bit of a Jeff Lynn sort of vibe, 70s vibe, 70s sort of Jeff, it's the drum sound of the piano, the Lady Madonna sort of, and that sound that they got on Lady Madonna is a certain miking technique. Jeff always uses that and he doubles it up. And then Jeff will do the Spectre thing, he'll double track everything five times, you know, and then gets that wall of sound.
Yeah.
And then, but he does it really super tight. Everything's super tight, isn't it? With this, but it still sounds amazing, you know. So there's a little bit of a homage there, I think, to that, but also just to that 70s songwriting tradition. Step into the misty mountain. Put your hair like amber honey. To feeling warm in breezes. Let me sweet breathe. Let me hear your sweet, sweet laughter. If you love the conversation, we're in a certain solution. Give me love, 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 love. Be my life, my passion. Give me love, love, love. Oh, make my life my passion. Sail away.
Lifelong passion. This is beautiful, mystical, and pastoral. Again, I'm hearing Syd Barrett era Floyd here for me.
Syd Barrett, Nick Drake, he casts a deep anchor into a deep world, Paul. He can, he, you know, when emotionally, maybe because of his mother dying, maybe because of his Irish roots, there's something clicks and then he just goes deep and you're like, and that's one of those. Profound, yeah, beautiful. Yeah, I think that came out of a demo, but it was basically, you know, him taking the lead on that one a bit.
Yeah, and again, it's him just resting that much longer on a single chord, and it opens up so much opportunities for melodies and instrumentation as well.
But you know what? I've been writing a song recently that I think, again, is another Fairport riff. Or it might be just a traditional Irish one. It might be Butcher's Boy, which is an old Irish traditional song. But it's, when I listened to this yesterday, I thought, shit, that's just almost the same riff. It's a da 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 da, but different second and third augmentations. But and I forgot that. And I thought, oh, that's probably was the source Butcher's Boy might have been the source of that, because we were doing these on the solstice or on things, so I'd often be referencing Sandy Denny, She Walked Through the Fair, or Strawberry Ships Oceans as a reference to a folk song, to another mystical Irish one. It might be Butcher's Boy, actually. But because, you know, Paul's Irish, essentially, you know, he really got that intrinsically. Although you don't really hear that in the Beatles or Wings very much, that no. There's an Irish thing there. But it's there. And, yeah, it just pours out. And, like, well, in those sessions it did. And that song. Wow. People think, oh, that's easy. People put records. There's 20,000 songs released a day from people doing that. And that's all very well. That's great. But you try and do it yourself.
Yeah.
It's a thing.
I can't say I have. You've put me right off now.
You know, essentially, as an artist, people don't realise that you go in the studio every day, or I do, and it's not like, oh, what am I going to make today? You know, it's like, oh, my God, there's my work. You know, I'm going to have to throw that 3 days away. It's just terrible, you know. You could be so really, really brutally cruel to your own work. Mm. And then you have a coffee and have a smoke, and then you go, actually, that looks pretty good now. Doesn't look too bad. And then you're like, wait a minute, actually, that bit's fantastic.
Yeah.
You know, and that never changes. If you, from when you start to when you're 70-year-old Bob Dylan, you're still going to have that blank page to deal with and yourself. And that is still remains one of the hardest things anyone can ever do. And that's the reality of the artist. That is the real reality of the artist. They have to go through that every day. Nobody sees that. They just see the glamorous result of that. But the process of them doing that every day, what they put themselves through to get that, will kill some people, you know, and kills many artists, you know. So, you know, it's a big privilege. I take it seriously in having that responsibility and making records with them. And it's a great honor.
Moving on to Is This Love, another rustic, folky song.
Yeah, just a beautiful melody. I mean, he is Mr. Melody, isn't he? He's one of the great melodicists of the last 100 years, possibly one of the great lyricists of the last 100 years, certainly one of the great songwriters of the last 100 years. And that's a great example of how the melodies just fly out of him. They're mystical, you know, he's just asking that great question of, is this love? What is love? What are we doing? Where are we going? What's it all about? Who knows?
I think it's much of the song, again, it's floating on this chord, and you get little whispers of vibraphone. So these instruments are all lying around. Was it literally a case of, yeah, we'll have a bit of vibraphone on this. Oh, there's a tambourine.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's what studios are. They're sort of set up, especially private studios. He's got all his guitars there, all his instruments, a lot of the Beatles kit. So it's an incredible sweet shot to be locked in. And, yeah, you can just go from A to B. But in the end, none of that makes any difference. You give him a plank of wood and a bit of wire, you make a great sound out of it. And
yeah.
What these records are about, is it about emotions, about feelings, sometimes put into words, sometimes just into sound, melancholy and joy. And all those instruments do is facilitate that and give you a way of expressing that feeling, you know, or he, or for him. So it's really what I focus on is getting the right vibe and feeling. And then the instrument will suggest itself in a way. And, you know, we'll try a few. Not all will make the cut, but most do. And he's an amazing improviser because he doesn't read. He's just totally taught himself by ear. And so he can pick up anything and get a melody out of it straight away.
I think we're underestimating what you brought to this album. I mean, you've managed to turn, on this song, for example, it's everything's 1967. You can hear Paul sounds so relaxed. And again, there's no other album Paul sounds like this on. And it's such a beautiful, warm, surreal production that he's, you know, he could never do again, unless you're hoping to do another album, please.
Well, never say never, but thank you. I think it is one of his best records. It's a beautiful record. And the songwriting and the melodies, innovation, it's all there. It's up with some of his best work. Maybe that's not for me to say, but I can listen to it as a fan, and I'm more informed by my experiences as a fan than I am as a musician. And I was a massive fan of music before I even picked up a musical instrument, and ever since I've never stopped being a fan. And I'm far enough away perspective to hear it as a fresh thing, and it sounds incredible. And I'm so glad we made that record. You know,
so a lot of people.
It's there, you know, and he's I think another big part of that album, especially with the lyrics and the writing, was Allen Ginsberg. We spent a lot of time talking about Allen, and one of the big books of poetry I had there is a big compendium of Allen Ginsberg's work. Realised just how much Ginsberg was so important to all of what we've been talking about, because without Ginsberg, you wouldn't have had that Summer of Love. Without Ginsberg, you wouldn't have had the Beats. Without the Beats, you wouldn't have had that Summer of Love. Without that Summer of Love, Beatles would never have made Sgt. Pepper. All roads lead back to Ginsberg when it comes to contemporary, you know, pop culture, I think. So,
well, the album title, wasn't that Electric Arguments, wasn't that Ginsberg?
Is it?
I'm sure I saw an interview where Paul was saying that was a line from a Ginsberg book.
Could very well be likely, because that's where the lyrics, we were cutting up all these different writers, especially Ginsberg. Could be very true, yeah. But Ginsberg's such a big part of it, and he was a good friend of Paul.
Next, Lovers in a Dream. We've got Paul on cello on this.
That's right. That's playing the Bill Black double bass with a bow.
Really?
This one is basically, my brief with Paul on this was, the atmosphere and the drones is very Popol Vuh. Florian Frick, who was the genius composer who soundtracked most of the early Herzog movies and a big part of the Kamish krautrock scene in the 70s electronic German scene. So meets the Doors, because both Paul and Linda are big Jim Morrison fans, actually. And,
really?
I think Linda photographed Jim a few times and knew him. We would often talk about Jim because I really love the Doors, but the Doors aren't always really super hip in super hip circles. So,
yeah.
But a lot of people, I was going to say Primal Scream, but I'm sure Bobby loves Jim Morrison. But Bobby would be going, oh, no, MC5, I love Jim. But no, Bobby would love Jim Morrison. But some bands like that would be like, no, the Doors are a pop group, you know.
Sold out, yeah.
Yeah, They never got the super hip gravitas from the critics. They got it from the fans, but not so much from the critics. And but there was something really wonderful in Dionysian and Byron-esque of Jim, and he was an amazing performer. So that one was like his American Prayer recordings of him reciting his poetry. That was really the direction for this one, where Paul had his words, and I said, let's do it in the way that Jim did that poetry album, and you just almost speak it. And then I'll put this sort of trancey, Comiche sort of journey sound to it. So, I mean, again, like, you could tell we had a good rapport, because anybody else suggesting that to someone like Paul McCartney would be shown the door and ushered into a taxi very quickly, or to the nearest mental hospital, probably. But again, it works. And what's wonderful is when you do that kind of direct, deliberate sourcing, when you mash it up with something else, suddenly all those sources disappear. Those bones are well and truly buried. And they just it just becomes an original piece. You know, it's weird. That's great. Yeah.
That's lovely as well. I'll just quickly introduce it, yeah? And then Universal Here, Everlasting Now. Over to you. I didn't say it would be a big introduction.
Yeah, that's cool. That could be a track that I Hit the Young Band could make today, and people go, wow, that's super fresh. It's so well ahead of its time, isn't it? It starts off with this Eno, sort of Roger Eno, sort of piano piece. Paul had been doing a lot of symphonic work, writing symphonies. I think he was doing some underwater sort of soundtrack. I'm not even sure if that came out, but he'd been doing a lot of piano classical music. So that, I wanted to capture a little bit of that in there. You know, obviously I come from 80s... The Orb, Little Fluffy Clouds, all of that. So it's always going to be in these records, I think, because it wasn't a Paul McCartney record. I could put that in there, you know, without it being too much of a gimmick. Yeah. I think also because the first album was so radical in its extreme sort of tranciness and ambientness. And it was unique even within that genre, because all the sounds were from his album or things he played, but I rearranged them into a very techno ambient way. We'd already done it, so we'd already set a precedent of being allowed to do that.
Yeah.
So it felt like appropriate to do it here and there. So the dog, I mean, Paul's obviously a big animal lover, you know, and champion of vegetarian things with Linda. And so the dogs are in there. That's very all, but it's so lovely that those things are in there.
Don't Stop Running.
Certainly, this is another one that, you know, was inspired from the British folk rock revival, or the third folk revival, which was folk rock in the 60s, after McCarthy and Ewan McColl. I think they were the frontline first folk revivalists in the 50s. Mm. By the time the Fairports came along, they were like the third, I think, and... It's definitely got that Sandy Denny vibe. And because of that, actually, it's got a bit of a Zeppelin vibe, I think, you know, with the Zeppelin folk thing, that sort of descending arpeggio thing of very Zeppelin. And, of course, that when that beat comes in, that actually then gives it, weirdly, it becomes a bit Portishead and Trip-Hop and Bristol, yeah, because they use that on Glory Box for some reason. It's got a similar thing with the organ as well. I don't think that was a specific reference, but listening to it then, that just made me think of that.
Mm.
And then he had those two couple of, you know, Silent Running and
Silent Lovers,
yeah.
That was a William Burroughs thing as well, wasn't it? Or Cut Up.
Silent Lovers. I don't remember that one being. I think those are some of his lines. But he didn't always tell me what lines were which. You know, he just said, "I go, you got 20 minutes. I'm going to do some editing. Get your lyric." And he go, "Okay." And then I go, "Ready?" Go, "Yeah." And then he wouldn't always tell me which ones he cut up. I wouldn't have seen it, or which ones he just channeled down. So I'm not entirely sure on that. But yeah, really nice. Really nice. It does feel like it's a double album, doesn't it? I mean, I've always thought of it as a single album, but I mean, it's 14 tracks.
And then there's a bonus track, Road Trip.
Yeah, so that one, I think that was just me stretching down some recordings and creating an ambient wash of different elements. Very much like the KLF Chill Out or early orb stuff I was doing.
Yeah.
And very much in keeping with rushes, really. There's a lot of rushes like that. So maybe it was to keep a bit of continuity to that. Maybe, I mean, Paul really loved listening to music when he was in the car. And he had, you know, his driver, stroke roadie, cameraman, everything, John, would take a CD in the session, they'd drive off, and they both give me their verdicts.
Really? You know?
And I'd asked John, I said, "Well, what about the woman?" He goes, "Oh, we love this one. I'm not sure about that one."
All right.
What a wonderful little surprise that was. I've forgotten about that almost entirely. And great that it's on as a bonus edition, yeah, because it's a big part of who the Firemen are, is that sort of aesthetic and sound. So it's good. It ends that album. It makes that album just absolutely epic by the end of it. What a journey.
Yeah. Incredible. Indeed. So, thank you so much. Overall, what does the Firemen Project mean to you?
Well, as I explained earlier, I think the Firemen is really Paul being experimental. But you could say all of Paul's best work has been experimental. Yeah. So, all his work's experimental, but some of it's more Paul McCartney and some of it's more Beatles, and some of it's more Firemen. It's definitely a different personality of his that comes together when we work together somehow. I'm so privileged and honoured that he invited me to be a collaborator on that project rather than just a producer or a remixer or something. And it became a band, you know, and I'm like, wow. But that is what it is, because it's Paul with whatever I bring to that party on that particular track, which different things, different times, but does sound different. I thought it was encouraging when I heard Three, which he did in lockdown. There are a lot of Fireman-esque elements on that album, and I thought how lovely I've had an influence on him in some way, an empowering influence that's allowed him to make a record all by himself, pretty much at home. And I thought that was beautiful. I thought it was a pretty good album as well, one of his best. So I think the legacy is very strong, and even though this album and the other Firemen album are probably his least commercial successful records, they remain some of his highest artistic achievements, I think. So I'm doubly happy and joyfully delighted to be in some small way involved in that.
Youth. Thank you so much.
Pleasure, Chris. Thanks. Really enjoyed talking to you. Hey!